Live in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, you are listening to Studio 2. Welcome. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. This is our first July show.
It is indeed. Did you like my little intro there?
I did.
I spiced it up. Trying some things. And we are trying a new thing today.
We are trying a new thing because our big topic today is about the woes of airport travel. I've had some of the worst travel experience of my life in the past year. But I realized, and you probably realized, we are not alone here. So we have a big question for the audience, and we hope you'll participate.
Yeah. It's a new format. We're going to ask one big question at the top of the show and try to sort of string that thread through the rest of the show.
Yep.
Okay. The question today, if you could change one thing about air travel or airports, what would it be?
That's a good question.
Studio 2 at WHYY.org, 888-477-9499. If you could change one thing, what would you change?
Yeah. And thanks to everybody who's commented on Facebook. We even got a voicemail. We got people talking about this. So call us. We want to hear from you.
It's bubbling. The one big question.
Yes. And that'll be our big topic, middle of the show. Later, just in a few minutes, we're going to be talking about the Sixers. And I know you're a hoops fan, Avi.
Love hoops.
Yeah. Paul George just signed to the Sixers. We're going to talk about what that means for the upcoming season.
Sounds good.
Yeah. And then for the last segment, we're going to be talking to Liz Moore. Today is release day for her latest novel, The God of the Woods. It's a mystery set in the Adirondacks.
But she's set in Philly.
She's set in Philadelphia, and it's getting rave reviews. So, you know, I'll chat with her later today.
888-477-9499. Email us, studio2 at whyy.org. Some quick news headlines. First, this just broke within the last hour or so. As you probably know, the Parker administration here in Philadelphia wants all city workers to return to the office by July 15th, but the union representing about 6,000 city employees has just sued to try to stall that or perhaps stop it. Not much more that we can say at this point. Except there's a lawsuit. This deadline's in 13 days, and as we are fond of saying on this program, Cherry, we shall see.
Yeah, a judge will have to rule to decide whether or not they go back to work or keep things as is until they figure this thing out. Another story that caught our eye today, Senator Bob Casey has broken his silence on President Biden's debate performance.
He's whispering out.
Very quietly showing his support. Now, you probably heard over the weekend several Democratic lawmakers they immediately rallied behind the president after that lackluster performance. I saw it. You probably heard about it. All of this stuff, including Pennsylvania Governor Shapiro, Senator John Fetterman, but Senator Bob Casey, crickets. Okay. But yesterday, he reluctantly answered questions at a campaign stop in Scranton. And here's what he had to say.
Look, he had a bad night in a debate, but look, I think people know what's at stake in this race. It's true at the national level. It's true in my race. It's as clear a choice as you could imagine.
So what makes Casey different than those other two? He's running for re-election, right?
He
has a really tough challenger, Dave McCormick, who's already run for office here in Pennsylvania and has a ton of money.
Yeah.
And so his silence is a bit telling. His tepid response is telling. And it's also telling because Casey and Biden aren't just political allies. They are real life friends. They are both guys with Scranton roots. They have a long history together. So clearly, I think you can read between the lines. Democrats who are up for re-election in swing states don't really want to talk about this.
They're trying to put distance between them. They are afraid that Biden as a candidate could make voter turnout low and that could hinder their election or re-election in Casey's case. But I will tell you this, Avi.
Okay.
The one comment that I heard all weekend repeatedly was Democrats should take a lesson from the GOP when it comes to being ride or die.
Blind support.
Just ride or die. And okay. Casey's supposed to be a bestie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ride or die. And the question is, are they right, though? Will the support of Biden impact voter turnout? We don't know.
Casey has consistently pulled ahead of Biden in every single poll that we've seen of the Keystone State. Maybe not every single, but every one that I've seen. And so the question is, can McCormick sort of take Casey attach him to Biden firmly enough that they're kind of in lockstep together. I think that's hard to do because it's hard to cut through the noise of a big national race and change people's mind about someone further down the ticket. I think that's a tough task for McCormick. He's clearly going to try.
Yeah.
Over to the Garden State now. Another thing that broke this morning, the federal government gave the green light to a big offshore wind project in New Jersey. Now, this is not the one by the Danish company Ørsted. That company pulled out of the project. That project is dead for now. This is another project called Atlantic Shores South, but it's got the green light from the federal government. It's still a pretty big project that would bring wind energy to New Jersey, likely by the end of the decade. And as far as we know so far, it's moving forward, and it did clear a big hurdle today.
Yeah, absolutely. We should remind you that there's still a lot of community opposition. Folks have kind of come together and said they're going to oppose this. So we'll see. It's gotten far as any other project so far. So we'll be watching
But you never know. And by the way, in Delaware, they made a big step toward bringing wind energy to the Delaware shore, passing a bill that would start a procurement process for building offshore wind in Delaware. Delaware's got much less coastline, but still, that's potentially huge for the first state. So things are blowing in the wind energy sector.
And we're sticking in Delaware, something that's still, you know, we'll see. Dog owners in Delaware, they could soon be forced to pay up for their furry friend's excessive barking.
Explain.
Now, and you're a cat person. I'm a dog person. But this is it. So there's a bill that passed the legislature last week that would create fines up to $150 for dogs that bark more than 15 minutes straight or intermittently for a half hour. There are exceptions for animal shelters, pet stores, and vet clinics. This bill right now is sitting on Governor Carney's desk. Some pet owners, they're a little upset, a little peeved, because it doesn't take into account why the dogs are barking. What if the dog is sick? What if there is a thunderstorm? There are so many, you know, reasons. What if the dog has, you know, some PTSD or something? We don't know. And the bottom line is, dogs bark. Okay, that's what they do. It's part of their little nature. And they're so cute and fuzzy, you know, even when they bark sometimes. But how are you going to, I mean, what is this going to lead to? Are you people going to be muzzling their dogs now if they bark too much? Is it going to cause dog abuse? So I don't know. It was interesting. Your thoughts as a cat person?
I'm with you. I mean, I'm not a big fan of dogs. I don't own any dogs, but I don't understand what a person is supposed to do. You can't reason with a dog and tell it to stop barking.
You're like, stop, Grover. Gotta be quiet before I get this ticket.
Why do you go with Grover?
I'm Greg. Grover Greg.
Oh, Grover Greg. Got it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so, alliteration. Totally understood. Speaking of alliteration, Twisted Tea. Yes. Have you heard of this beverage? If you live in Philadelphia, I think you have. Philadelphia Magazine did a deep dive into this beverage called Twisted Tea. It's kind of what it sounds like. It's alcoholic sweet tea. It's really not popular anywhere else in the country except Philadelphia, where it's massively popular. Mm-hmm. So Philly Mag did this deep dive to find out kind of the origin story of Twisted Tea. And it seems like maybe it took off because there was a bar down the shore in Wildwood that started like promoting it. And then people took it back to Northeast Philadelphia, where it is really, really popular. But the truth is, it's still kind of a mystery. What I found interesting about the story is that Twisted Tea started as a different product. It was called Bodine's, I think. And anyways, they got sued and they had to change the name.
But I think Twisted Tea is a better name.
Oh, it's a much better name.
Bodine's. I mean, come on now.
Sometimes lawsuits can be your best friend.
Absolutely.
But they've started to market this drink as like a high-end drink to sort of like fancy people. And they found out very quickly, much to their surprise, the company that creates it, that actually blue-collar folks were much more likely to drink it. And so they changed the marketing. They targeted places like Philadelphia. And the rest is Twisted Tea history.
Have you had Twisted Tea?
Why? See?
I got to ask. I go right to it. I go right to the heart of it. Have you had some?
I love you, Philadelphia. And please don't kick me out. I have never tried Twisted Tea.
Well, I will tell you this. Mm-hmm. It's delicious.
There's
I have some
review.
In the refrigerator right now. Okay. The half and half is like an Arnold Palmer style. Mm-hmm. It's half lemonade, half tea. It's delicious. It's nice to drink. It's a very refreshing drink.
Cheers to you, Cherry.
Yeah. And plus, I will say, you go to the wine and spirit stores, it's everywhere.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So they kind of push it on you.
It is crazy. So. It is crazy. Hopefully, we'll be cheersing on Broad Street this time next year because the Philadelphia 76ers will have won an NBA championship. And I will drink Twisted Tea if that happens.
All right. We'll be clinking the cans. The Philadelphia 76ers, you probably heard, have had a busy couple of weeks. They drafted a guard out of Duke who also happens to be a TikTok star. Then they used a big contract to sign an all-star, the one and only Paul George. The veteran joins fellow all-stars Tyrese Maxey and Joel Embiid on a team that hopes to compete for next year's championship.
So is this the season the Sixers finally break through? To answer that question and get us up to speed, we have Marcus Hayes, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Marcus, welcome back to Studio 2.
Hey, Abby. Hey, Cherry. How y'all guys doing today?
We are doing great. We want to know how you're doing. How are you feeling about Paul George being on the Philadelphia 76ers?
You know, it's complicated. Like, I can't criticize the Sixers for acquiring the player that is most economical, believe it or not, even at $212 million, because my choice would have been to trade for Brandon Ingram of the New Orleans Pelicans, but that would have cost you draft choices and even more in salary, because you most definitely would want to extend him. He's only 26 years old, and he's not as good a player as Paul George is right now. He might be one day, but that's a pretty big gamble. So I can't blame them for doing this, but does it make them an NBA title contender? Certainly not. Does it make them a contender in the Eastern
Conference?
Probably not. You know, they're not as good as the Boston Celtics. I don't think they're nearly as good as the Milwaukee Bucks when the Milwaukee Bucks are whole, when Giannis Antetokounmpo is healthy. And they're probably not as good as the Knicks now that they've got Mikal Bridges. And everybody seems to forget that, you know, the Knicks were good before they got Mikal Bridges. And they have a guy named Julius Randle that nobody's talking about. They may trade him, but Julius Randle is probably their most consistent offensive player, including all the other guys.
All right. Marcus is raining on our parade here. We're making parade
plans. People were happy, Marcus. People were happy.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. It's not that the Sixers got worse. It's that everybody else is already so good.
Okay.
Well, I do have one question. My big question for you, Marcus, is will the Sixers have to change their offense now that they have George? I mean, because the offense has been so dependent on Joel Embiid. Now that we have this guy who can shoot, will we be able to sort of rearrange things so that we can win even when Joel is not there?
Well, we've tried to do that here in Philadelphia for a couple of years. If you remember, James Harden was brought in.
But he was a divo.
A divo. Okay.
Well, Paul George has never been a shrinking violet. Paul George really loves himself some Paul George. I mean, it's the NBA. Let's be honest. I mean, they drafted Jared McCain, and, you know, he's more famous for his TikToks than he is for his jump shot. So it's the nature of the beast. I think the question is, can Paul George do what Tobias Harris couldn't do? Be sort of an effective score when asked to be, and that's intermittently without a defined role. That's a really hard job. Tobias didn't do it very well. James Harden didn't do it very well. Can Paul George do it? Probably better than those two guys, because he's had to do it in the past.
Oh, that's positive. All right, real quick before we get you out of here, you mentioned Jared McCain. The team just drafted this player out of Duke. He's a young guy. He's very good at basketball, but he is perhaps more famous for being a TikTok star. What do you think about this Jared McCain selection, and how do you think fans will respond to him? He definitely has a different personality.
I know how my three teenage daughters who are basketball players and their best friends who are also basketball players responded to him. They were ecstatic. They knew more about Jared McCain than I did, because they're all on TikTok. The hardcore basketball fans were like, why didn't you take Dalton Connect out of Tennessee? He's a better shooter. He's a bigger guy. He's not a great athlete. He went to three colleges. He's kind of a one-trick pony. He's 23 years old. He can't play defense. I will say this. The last time the Sixers, under Daryl Morey, took a guard without really a position, point guard or shooting guard, that not a lot of people knew a whole lot about, it turned out okay. His name is Tyrese Maxey. And they took him in 2020, and they just gave him $200 million over the next 5 years because he developed the way they hoped that Jared McCain will.
I love it. I love that comparison. I like to hear any Tyrese Maxey comparison. That was Marcus Hayes, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, getting us up to speed on the Sixers. Marcus, thanks for your time today on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me, guys.
And coming up, summer travel headaches at the airport. You've had to take a Tylenol. I've had to take a Tylenol to deal with the pains of flying. And one of our listeners, Mark from Elkton, Maryland, says arrivals after midnight mean less staff and closed baggage terminals. He also had a horrible experience. Take a listen.
Because of the skeleton crew, we had to sit on the tarmac or sit on the plane for 2.5 hours. And all the luggage was backed up just because of all the canceled flights and all the delayed flights. We escalated things to American Airlines. Never really got any response there.
Oh, sounds brutal.
Poor
Mark. Hate to hear it, Mark. That leads us to our question today. What's the one thing that you would change about the flying experience? Airport, plane, whatever it is. Email studio2@whyy.org. Call us 888-477-9499. The emails are already coming in. We'll read some of them in the next segment, which is all about air travel as we get ready for a very busy travel season. So stick with us on Studio 2. What is the one thing you would change about flying? Email us studio2@whyy.org and keep it locked here.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Aviation Wolfman Ahrens. Airports across the country are packed this week. TSA is predicting outrageously high numbers of travelers for the 4th of July holiday. The agency screened nearly 3 million flyers on Sunday, breaking the record for a single day, and they expect to break that record again this week.
The numbers come amid changes like supply chain delays, new regulations, and extreme weather, and I meant challenges. And consumers are often the ones who feel the pain, delays and cancellations, overbooked flights, baggage fees, crammed overhead bins, hours-long lines. There's a lot to rightfully complain about. So joining us now to talk about the potential headache of summer travel is Hannah Sampson. She's a travel reporter for The Washington Post. Hannah, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And thanks for being here. We already have lots of listeners sharing their lousy airport experiences via social media. We want to hear from you live. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org to answer our big question today. What is the one thing you would change about flying? Frank, who is one of the regulars at our Instagram office hours, says he would like to see the check-in improved. So that's the one thing Frank would change. What's the one thing you would change? Email us, studio2@whyy.org.
And Hannah, I've dealt with it all. Delays, cancellations, postponements. Just during the past year, my past few trips. But I understand I'm not alone. There are several real reasons why air travel has been miserable lately. What is going on, Hannah?
I mean, it. If you look back over the last 4 years, it's just been such a roller coaster. Starting with, you know, the pandemic, the stretch that immediately followed, the early days of the pandemic were strained by staffing issues and not enough planes flying. That's kind of behind us now. But what we have now is everybody wants to be out again traveling. So we have these record upon record. I think the top 10 records have been set in the last, since May, basically, for TSA checkpoints. So you've got huge crowds, you've got unpredictable summer weather, which happens every year, but it's just getting even more unpredictable and stormy. So that can just throw a wrench into your entire vacation plans. And we still, you know, we still have some bumps in, staffing is pretty much back, but you still run into pilots timing out and they're just not being enough people to handle your bags sometimes. Airlines have gotten better at that, but it still is no guarantee that you're going to have a smooth trip, especially in the summer.
Wow. Amanda says the one thing they would change is they would redo the overhead bins so there's one per seat, label them by seat. That does seem like a utopia. But can you give us a sense of sort of the changes in baggage culture over the last 20 years? Because it does seem like there's a huge shift from checked to carry on. Why did that happen and where is it headed?
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to talk about this.
Good, go for it.
So really what happened was around 2008, the first main airline, it was American Airlines, started charging for a checked bag. So you used to be able to check bags for free, like your first or second bag for free. And then they were like, no, we could make some more money. They're struggling financially. So they started to implement these bag fees for checked bags, and other airlines followed suit. So then what you had was people not wanting to pay to check their bags, and they're bringing their bags on board. But the planes weren't really set up for that at that point. So you move into this new era when suddenly people are trying to beat these extra fees and cram everything into carry-ons that they would put overhead. There's not room for that. And then it goes from there, where some airlines then start charging for carry-on bags. Mm. And that adds a whole new set of fees for people and a whole new set of delays as people are getting on planes and, stopping to hoist their bags up. But one thing that is promising is that some airlines on the newer jets that they've ordered do have larger overhead spaces. I don't think it's that utopia. I don't think it's the utopia that you mentioned, but it is roomier, and it should really be solving a lot of that problem. The one issue is that everybody has to read the instructions really carefully on how to load the bag in, because if you're doing it the wrong way, it's not going to fit, and the whole puzzle is going to fall apart and require somebody to step in and rearrange it like a Rubik's Cube. So, nothing, one step forward, maybe one step back, but whoever complained about overhead bins, like in a future flight, hopefully they will end up on a plane with a roomier storage area.
Yeah. And I have to say, Aria says this, she says, she said the seats have gotten smaller and so have the bulkheads. My carry-on that I've used since I was 18 won't fit into the American Airlines overhead bin. So she feels like things have gotten smaller. I'm 5'11", okay? And like Cynthia, larger seats and larger legroom. That's one thing she would change. They seem like it's tighter in there when you sit down, like there's less legroom. Is that true?
Yeah, it depends on the airline, but some airlines that you fly, and probably over time, most of them have tried to cram in some extra seats. So what's called the pitch, which is another term for basically the leg room, it's a very specific measurement, but the pitch has gotten smaller over time. So it really does mean you're feeling more crammed. And maybe the airlines are making a little bit more money when they fill up every plane, but that comes on the back of your comfort. You're not imagining this. You are definitely feeling more cramped. And a plane or an airline like Spirit especially has gotten very good at like making their seats thinner and being able to get more of the seats in. So they say as a result, they can charge you a lower fare because they can put more seats on the plane. But if you want that extra leg room or a little more comfort, you have to pay basically to get a little more comfort and a little more room.
The spirit of savings.
That's right.
The frontier of making us less comfortable. Thank you to those budget airlines. So we're asking our one big question today on Studio 2. What would you change about flying? Email us studio2@whyy.org. And we're talking with Hannah Sampson, who's a travel reporter for The Washington Post. Lots of people are writing in about boarding and deplaning. Mm-hmm. Nancy says the one thing I would change, the length and unpredictability of time it takes to get your butt in the airplane seat. Thank you, Nancy. Robin says, every time I fly, I wonder why we don't load the plane from the back seats first.
I agree with
Robin. First class can still board first, but then start from the back. It would have been so much quicker and less stressful for all. There have been changes in how planes are boarded. There are these weird amorphous zones. Why did that happen? And is there anything we can do to fix this problem?
So a lot of time the zones are based on who paid more for their ticket. So like you mentioned first class, yes, that is a perk. But also if you have paid the very lowest amount for your ticket, that's usually called basic economy, that will get you loading into the plane last. And maybe you're in the back, but you have no privilege for getting on the plane, basically, if you haven't paid a little bit extra. I think that, there have been different experiments. I used to, when I would fly JetBlue a lot, I knew always to book like behind seat, I think it was 23 or 28, because that would board first. And so that was like my hack on JetBlue. But then they changed their policy. And I truly don't understand what their method is now. But I couldn't rely on that anymore. And then you have the Southwest model where you don't have you don't pick a seat, you just get a boarding position. And it's just all over the board. You could board first and go right to the middle, or you can go anywhere. And it's they like it for whatever reason, but they also might be changing their policy. So it's super confusing. I don't know if it makes sense to the airlines.
Yeah.
I assume somewhere somebody knows what they're doing and why. But I also think these things are being experimented with a lot. And I don't think anybody should feel like they understand or should get comfortable with a hack at one particular airline, because I suspect they will keep tweaking until they have it down to the most efficient science, because that's what matters to airlines is efficiency. And if they're not getting that, they're going to keep working on it.
Yeah. Julia says, how about the economic stratification of different class seating? It's getting worse and worse. First class passengers can literally have their own rooms, walk around and go to the bar while coach
what?
Passengers
that
are
true?
Stacked in
not the
back.
Not the planes I've been on.
So Julia says, I'd love to see an airline split the space equally amongst the passengers and offer affordable prices for tickets. I got to ask you the economics, Hannah, because when I first started flying 20 years ago, I mean, I remember I was working in corporate. I finally bumped up and could get, you know, all the benefits. I was platinum, right?
Wow, look at you.
It was good. I traveled a lot for work. And then now all of those privileges are gone. You got to pay for everything. What is the economics of this? Are airlines making more money now that they've taken all the perks away and made it the basic experience pretty miserable for most folks?
Yeah, I mean, that experience that your listener wrote about, I think that is something you could find on some international flights on the super shishi airlines. You do have incredible amenities in first class on some foreign airlines usually. I would say like first class a lot of the time in the US is not all that much to write home about. So it's not the greatest, but you do have a bigger seat, you do have a little more space, and you do have a guaranteed place for your bags overhead. So airlines do make a lot more money off of those travelers than the ones of us who are in the back paying the lowest fare. So they really do want them. They really do cater to them. They're actually portioning more parts of the cabin for the people who will pay premium economy or economy plus. Like, you'll plus up your basic ticket and they want to cater to you. And true, the rest of us, it's just not a great experience. Your listener was right on. And it is all economy. The airlines who do kind of a more one size fits all flying for the people approach, I'm thinking of Southwest specifically, that doesn't even have a first class, they're struggling right now financially.
Oh,
and it is not paying for them. The ones that are doing better are the ones that have these parts of the cabin that people will pay through the teeth for. So, you know, you're really out of luck unless you're willing to pay the extra or change some of your miles in for a more comfortable seat.
Yeah. Stratification pays, even with security, because there are now alternatives in the TSA line.
Yeah,
and a lot of people wrote in about TSA when we asked what's the one thing you would change about air travel. Mm-hmm. Steve says TSA employees loudly barking instructions at you.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel has a really interesting one. Rachel says they would change the uniform they would want uniform expectations at security. Airport to airport, the TSA enforced the rules for going through security differently. Even at one airport, I saw one line get told not to take off their shoes, and another one got yelled at because they didn't take off their shoes. What's going on with security? Has it changed at all? And I'll also add Bernie, by the way, who just says it's all security theater and they should get rid of it entirely. But what's going on with security? How is security changing? And why does it seem like there are these inconsistencies among airports or even within airports?
It's funny. I actually raised this to my colleagues a little bit earlier today. And literally, like, a bunch of travel reporters and editors were saying, yeah, I can bring my jacket to keep my jacket on at one airport and not the other. And or I get yelled at for taking my laptop out at one place and for keeping it in at another place. So this is something we have all experienced. And it really is a matter of the kind of technology that TSA is using at whatever checkpoint it is, even at different checkpoints in the same airport. If they're using, you know, a certain feature where they just scan your face and don't ask for your boarding pass and ID, that's one setup that is newer and is being rolled into airports. You know, not every airport, but some airports have it. So that's that's a sea change from when you just walked up and handed your boarding pass and your ID. But maybe you don't know that's going to happen. Some of the scanners do fine with laptops. Some of them don't. You really are not going to know what you're going to get until you get there. And you really have to listen to what TSA is saying or yelling in the background. Sometimes I wonder, like, why are they so angry at me at 5 in the morning? Why are they yelling at me about my shoes and laptops? And I assume often it's because, you know, you need to know what the rules are for this particular checkpoint at this particular time. I will say TSA PreCheck does make things easier. Typically, you usually can count on some consistency about like your shoes and laptop and liquids. But even that's not a guarantee.
And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Hannah Sampson, travel reporter for The Washington Post. And our big question for this segment is, what is the one thing you would change about air travel? We want to hear from you. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Couple of more comments. One person says, Ted says, change procedures so passengers do not have to sit on the tarmac for hours for whatever cause. Allow plane to return to gate and passengers to deplane. So I want to ask you about delays, when you get refunds, when you don't. Are there any rules about this? Because I got stranded in Chicago once for a night. Lovely city, but it was cold at the time.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't that lovely. But can you get money back? When do you actually get compensated for your time when there's a delay or a cancellation?
Mm-hmm. So really briefly on the tarmac situation, there are rules in place that an airline isn't supposed to let you sit on a tarmac for, I believe it's more than 3 hours without giving you a chance to get off. It is a long time. It is a
long
time.
3 hours.
But if it gets super egregious beyond 3 hours, then that's where you can be looking up the tarmac delay rule on the DOT website on the plane and ring your buzzer and say, excuse me, can we please move forward with this rule? But for delays and cancellations and compensation, when you have the best opportunity to get something from the airline is when the delay or cancellation was within their control, if it's their fault, then they have to do things for you like food vouchers and a place to stay and transportation to the hotel if you're stranded overnight. However, if it is not their fault, if it's just something like weather, the refund that you're entitled to is if your flight is canceled or significantly delayed and you decide not to fly, like not to take that trip because it's been ruined by the delay, then they owe you a refund. And at the moment, you have to ask them for it and maybe decline the voucher that they'll offer you first. But soon, by the end of the year, they're really supposed to do that automatically. So if you decline to travel again because your cancellation or delay was so bad it ruined your trip, they're supposed to refund that money to the way that you bought your ticket automatically. That's a new rule that was announced in April by the DOT.
Seems fair.
So you're due. That is what you're due. Honestly, if it's a delay or a cancellation, that was not their fault.
Tom says airports should have playgrounds. I'll second that. That would be lovely.
Love it.
Stan says more public transportation options to and from airports and city centers. I'll also second that. Before we get you out of here, Hannah, I'll bring up one of my frustrations, which is when you go on a site like Kayak or Expedia, you search for a price and you think you're getting a cheap price, but it turns out there's a bunch of hidden fees. And I have heard that the federal government is actually doing something about this. So let's try to end on a positive note here. Are we actually going to be able to search for flights by what they actually cost?
This is another rule that the DOT announced a couple months ago. And they're calling it like a fee transparency rule. So when you search for the flight, along with the fare and the schedule, it will need to tell you what the cost of a carry-on bag or a checked bag would be, as well as the cost to cancel or change your flight. That's the good news for consumers. The maybe slightly worse news is that airlines are suing over rule. So as far as when it will be implemented, it's supposed to be really in place by next April. Airlines could do it sooner. It doesn't seem like they're all that eager to at the moment, but It is something that is in place and is moving forward. And, for consumers, if that's something you want, hopefully for you, it will be in place, you know, maybe before the next busy summer of travel. But yeah, stay tuned, I guess, for for more fee information on your search engines.
Yes, I would like to know how much the flight costs. I don't think that's asking too much, airlines. Okay, that is the voice of Hannah Sampson, travel reporter for The Washington Post. Hannah, thanks for joining us today on Studio 2 and gamely answering all of the complaints from our listeners. We really do appreciate it.
Super fun chat with you guys. Thank you so much.
Yes, and coming up, Philadelphia-based novelist Liz Moore. Her new book is out today. It's titled The God of the Woods. We'll chat with her after this break. Stick with us. Studio 2 will be right back. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg. Philadelphia author Liz Moore's new novel, The God of the Woods, is getting great reviews. And it was just released today. The Washington Post, Maureen Corrigan, wrote that breaking free of the spell Moore casts is close to impossible. And it's true. I mean, this story takes place across two decades, beginning in the 1950s. It's set at a summer camp surrounded by forests deep in the Adirondacks, and a forest that two siblings disappear into. They are the children of the wealthy Van Laar family who own the camp, and their disappearance happened 14 years apart. In addition to the mystery of the missing children, the God of the Woods takes on the issues of social class and gender roles of the time. And you may have read Liz Moore's other novels. There are four more, including the crime novel Long Bright River, about Philadelphia and its opioid crisis, that's being adapted for a series on Peacock. And Liz now joins me in studio to talk all about it all. Liz, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much, Cherry. I was just saying, I hear your voice all the time as I'm bopping around Philadelphia, so it's nice to see you in person.
Yeah, and I've said Adirondack so many times before, and then, of course, in the intro, I'm like, what? So congratulations on the book, and thank you for being here on release day. It's a really good book. I stayed up late reading it. It pulls you along. So I want you to start by laying the foundation for our talk. Set the scene, 1975, mm-hmm. Adirondacks. Tell us the story that kicks everything off.
Sure. So in the opening pages of The God of the Woods, we find out that the daughter of a very wealthy family who owns a summer home in the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York has gone to the summer camp that they also own and has disappeared toward the end of the summer. And this really sets into motion the rest of the book. We learn that there's a big cast of characters, including people from the wealthy family who are somewhat suspicious, people from the local community who also come under suspicion, and also the flashbacks occur to the 1950s when we learn that Barbara's brother, Bear, also went missing, not from the camp, but from the grounds. So it's kind of like a double mystery with an upstairs, downstairs thing going on as well.
Yeah, it's a lot going on in the story. And so this book takes us through the second missing person saga. This time, Barbara Van Laar, the sister of Bear you mentioned. I want you to read a selection from the book that sort of describes who she is.
Sure. The arrival of Barbara Van Laar at Camp Emerson was met mainly with silence. There was silence as the Van Laar's black town car rolled slowly up the driveway and then across the lawn, conducted by a driver. Silence as the girl herself, Barbara, traveled the half mile from the main house on foot, apparently having refused to ride alongside her own possessions. She came into view at 8:05 a.m., just as breakfast in the commissary was letting out. She saluted unsmilingly as she passed the exiting campers, who bumped into one another as they strained to get a look. She was wearing clothing the likes of which many of them had never seen, cut-off jean shorts that barely covered her bottom, and beneath them black stockings with intentional-looking runs in them, and black army boots, and a t-shirt with a word on it that none of them could quite make out, but presumed to be something rude. Her hair was artificially black and cut into a stringy bob that ended just below her jaw, and her lips were painted red and her eyes were rimmed in charcoal. Most surprising were the silver spikes, more than one, that adorned each earlobe, along with what appeared to be a dog collar encircling her neck and two black leather cuffs on her wrists. Barbara's inaugural walk across the lawn would be discussed for months afterward. It was the first time any of the campers had seen her in the flesh, though she'd been talked about for years. Most of the conversation centered on her appearance and attire, which was, to most of Camp Emerson, a shock. The only campers who knew what to call her were the Manhattanites, who used a word that the rest of them had never heard. Punk. Any other camper who arrived in Barbara's clothing would have been immediately shuttled to the bottom of the social heap, met with incredulity or ignored entirely. But Barbara Van Laar was too interesting to ignore, her personal history too intriguing and complex. Though no one said it aloud, the goal of every camper on the grounds was to befriend her.
Wow. That passage to me says so much about Barbara. She's like a walking rebellion. Can you tell us a little bit about the Van Laar family and the dynamic that she was raised in to become this young person?
Yeah, the Van Laars are a fictional dynastic American family based on many of the real dynastic American families who built summer homes in the Adirondacks that they called great camps, different than summer camps, just basically big mansions in the wilderness. And they did this, I'm talking about like the Roosevelts, the Vanderbilts, the Rockefellers, in the late 1800s and early 1900s. They did this in the footprint of local communities which consisted primarily of working class people mm-hmm. who often kind of served the wealthy family because they're, especially in the late 1800s and early 1900s, it was difficult to find produce or milk or meat. And so there was this really kind of like a microcosm, a tiny community unto itself. With all different social classes in the mix. And the Van Laars are based on that tradition that existed in the Adirondacks in the last century.
Yeah. And that forest, those mountains, are just the perfect setting for missing person cases. Can you explain why and just sort of describe that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would identify myself as a city person who has a lot of experience in the woods because I live in Philadelphia, and I've lived here for 16 years. My ancestors, actually, on my mother's side, came from the Adirondack Mountains. So in the early 1800s, four of my ancestors moved to the region and tried and failed to have sustainable family farms in the area. The government in that era, the New York State government, was attempting to build population in the region. And so they made what amounted to kind of false promises about plentiful arable land in that area. And I think my own ancestors were among the people who kind of fell for it because they moved there. And then within four generations, they had moved just south of there, which is where my mother was born and raised. So I've spent a lot of time there. We still have a family cabin in the woods that was built in the 1960s, which is much more modest in scale than the Van Laars mansion, I should say. But we go there. I bring my kids there. I've been going there since birth. And the setting of that cabin, the surroundings of that cabin, really informed the atmosphere of this novel.
Yeah, because it's easy to get lost. They actually told the young people at the camp, just sit down and yell. Don't try to find your way back to the trails.
Yeah, there's this phrase that's used in the book, when lost, sit down and yell. And it sounds kind of silly, but it's emblazoned on all these signs all over the camp. And that's the phrase that was taught to me when I was a kid, because it's incredibly easy to get disoriented in the woods, and it's incredibly easy to convince yourself, like, oh no, the trail is just that way. I know if I walk that way for 20 feet, I'll find the trail, when in fact you might be going in the complete wrong direction.
And the wonderful thing about this novel, as well as your other novels, is that you wrap in social problems, social ills. You talk about addiction here. You talk about women's roles, gender roles. You also talk about domestic violence. Why is this sort of a thing that you do with your novels? Because a lot of mysteries, they can go left and be very fantastical, but you sort of ground it in this gritty reality. Why do you use that as a tool?
Yeah, The God of the Woods and Long Bright River, I think, are firmly categorized as mysteries. But they are my fourth and fifth books, respectively. And I have three books I published before that were just sort of like realistic contemporary fiction. And so I sort of have a foot in the world of realistic fiction or traditional contemporary fiction, and then also a foot now in mystery. And that means that in all the books that I'm writing today, I'm as interested in things like character or theme, social class, gender inequality, things like that, as I am in telling a good propulsive story, which I hope The God of the Woods also does.
Yeah. And I want to mention that addiction is an issue that mm-hmm. came up in this book, as well as in your prior book, Long mm-hmm. Bright River. And you actually spent some time in Kensington, mm-hmm. Which is a section of Philadelphia that's dealing with the opioid crisis. What did you learn from that experience, and how did it inform your writing?
Yeah, I did community work leading free writing workshops at the Thea Bowman Center of St. Francis Inn. Thea Bowman Center was a women's day shelter. St. Francis Inn is a longstanding community organization in Kensington that has served the neighborhood for decades now. I want to qualify this by saying I've never resided in Kensington, and so mm-hmm. I think of myself more as a respectful outsider to the community. That said, I have a long family history of addiction myself, and so it was really the combination of time spent in Kensington and being a citizen of the larger city of Philadelphia, along with some of my personal history, that went into the writing of Long Bright River. And addiction, for those reasons, really is a theme that comes up in a lot of my books, including now The God of the Woods, although in a different way.
Yeah. And I got to mention, congratulations. Long Bright River is now being made into a series that's going to air on Peacock. That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
How involved are you in the production? Are you excited about this?
Yeah, I'm very excited about the production. I'm a co-creator and an executive producer on Long Bright River. The series, it's really, you know, a team effort, because there's a lot of voices involved in the creation of that series. I have been firmly instructed not to talk too much about the series yet, but I can say that I am really thrilled with the team, and I hope we are able to do justice to the book as well.
And for people who may not know, Long Bright River is about two sisters, one who is battling addiction, the other who is a cop, and it's centered in Kensington, so it has some Philly ties there.
That's right.
Yeah, and one of the things I found really interesting about you is you, in addition to being a writer on your fifth book, you know, you also run the MFA program at Temple University.
I do. As of July 1st, I am the newly appointed director of the MFA program in creative writing at Temple University. And I'm thrilled to be there. I've been there, I think I'm entering my sixth year there on faculty. And yeah, I rep Temple hard. I love Temple too.
I'm an adjunct in the Klein College.
I love that.
So
yeah.
Got to ask you, what is the sign when you mm-hmm. teach young people who are creative writers? Mm-hmm. What is the sign that you see, like, this is a writer who's going to take it all the way?
Okay, that is such a great question. Students I've taught, I teach, the MFA program is a grad program, but I also teach undergrads. And at every level, I think of voice as the single most deciding factor in whether somebody has it in them to take it all the way, to have a career in writing, and stamina. By voice, I mean something that just is incredibly propulsive, whether it's just the diction or the uniqueness of their voice or the way that they tell their story. And then by stamina, I mean somebody who is able to do the work to produce the book, because so many people are wildly talented but just can't, for whatever reason, get the words onto the paper. And so those two things are what I look for in my students.
Yeah, and as we wrap up, this book is hefty.
It is.
It's like 500 pages, Liz. Like, yeah. How did you, mm-hmm. you know, be able, and it goes through time, mm-hmm. it changes voices. Mm-hmm. How were you able to keep it all together and keep up the stamina, because you're a mom too, and yeah. teach, uh-huh. to be able to produce a 500-page book?
I only tell stories that I would really want to read, and some of my favorite summer reading experiences have been being completely immersed in a book in a nice location, or, you know what, on the L train on my way to work, or, you know, on public transportation, or wherever you are. I think the best summer reading lets you get lost, hopefully not too lost in the case of this book, but that's what I hope to write with The God of the Woods.
Yeah. Are you working on your next book already, or?
I do have something underway, but I have shown it to nobody, so I cannot speak to it.
No spoilers. No spoilers. And with that, I want to say thank you so much for being here on Studio 2.
Thank you, Terry. It's really a pleasure to meet you in person.
Yes. And Liz Moore is the author of five novels, including Heft and Long Bright River. And her brand new one out today is The God of the Woods. Congratulations again. Our show is now wrapped up. It's produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez engineered today's show from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. And for my co-host, Avi Wolfman-Arendt, I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Just like backyard barbecues or a day at the pool, the Three Rivers Festival has always been a part of our summer fun. And the festival returns July 12th to the 20th. It kicks off with the annual Three Rivers Festival Parade. Browse art in the park with local artisans. Bring the family to Children's Fest. Stroll through Junk Food Alley. And don't forget about the festival concerts at the Hoosier Lottery stage with live music from nationally renowned acts. You can buy your concert tickets or check out a schedule of events at threeriversfestival.org. Don't miss the best summer experience in Fort Wayne, the Three Rivers Festival.